Blog Talk Radio.
Today's date, October 25th, 2011 AD. Beautiful Alexandria, Virginia. Looking across at the Watergate Hotel right across the Potomac. I'm your host, Dr. C. Robert Jones, and you're listening to the C. Robert Jones Situation Report. Who is John Galt? Well, I swear by my life and my love of it that I will never live for the sake of another man, nor ask another man to live for mine. John Galt. Who is John Galt? I am John Galt. You're John Galt. If you believe that your life is your own, to live as you choose, to produce as you choose, and to expect value for value. If that is the case, then you are also John Galt. Value for value, which means that you don't expect anything. You don't expect something for nothing. You do not expect to be given anything. You expect to earn it. You expect no special favors. You expect to earn everything you get. You expect no corners be cut, no quarter be given. You work and you earn. You don't expect 40 acres and a mule. You don't expect reparations for something that you never suffered for. You don't expect that your debt be forgiven, debt that you rightfully accumulated. You do not expect that the world owes you anything. The only thing that you expect, if that is an opportunity to succeed in this world, in this great country, there, and if you believe that, then you are John Galt. I am John Galt. Now, those of us who are students and admirers of Ayn Rand's novels, two, most notably The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged, then you know what I say. You know what I mean when I ask the question, who is John Galt? Those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, I would highly recommend you pick up either of those books, either in audio form or paperback. I am John Galt. You are John Galt. Now, when we think of class warfare, we think of a political effort to pit the poor against the rich. The premise is that someone who has more than you is your enemy, which I suppose would be correct if you, instead to satisfy your own needs by means of might makes right, by taking from them through force or coercion, which would be the case with the Occupy Wall Street crowd. Rob from the rich to give to yourself. Think of the anomaly. Think of the irony when you have a group of protesters across the country protesting the rich, and demanding that the rich give either some of what they have earned to you, because they have it and you want it. You think that you deserve it. You deserve to have what they have earned because you believe that they've earned it unjustly. When you, the person who wants their wealth, haven't earned it at all, you simply exist. So the Wall Street crowd, the OWS crowd, believes that the wealthy people have tricked them out of their money or stolen money from them by saying, hey, you want to buy this $350,000 house? But you realize you only make $25,000, $30,000 a year. Do you still think you want to buy this house? Because I'll sell it to you if you think you can afford it. And you've got these greedy folks who think, well, yeah, I'll sign on the dotted line. I'll figure out some way. Boom. They're making $35,000 a year. They move into a $350,000 house. The house payment is around $1,500 a month. They've got all their other expenses. The next thing you know, they can't afford to pay the mortgage. The house is underwater. They're being foreclosed on. But because we have a Democrat Congress, we have president in the White House saying, well, you know what? That shouldn't happen to you. Just because you were just dumb enough to buy a house that you couldn't afford doesn't mean that you should have to move out and rent an apartment. You shouldn't have to move out of your house. That's not the way the American dream works, according to the Obama crowd and the OWS folks. You should be able to stay in that house because I have a heart. Never mind that you were stupid enough to sign on the dotted line with no down payment at all and move into that house knowing you couldn't afford it. Now, understanding class warfare. We need to understand class warfare. Assuming that both you and the rich person are capable of producing free trade holds that someone who has more than you should be your friend. They say that you can't get a job from a poor person. And it's hard to imagine a better relationship with a rich person than one who, or one which makes both of you richer. It's certainly more productive than a relationship which seeks to make you richer by making him poorer. An interviewer once asked Ayn Rand if it was okay for some men to have caviar while other men want for bread. For some reason, such questions seem more valid with a Russian flavor. If we know that caviar costs 100 times as much as bread, then we can imagine that 100 poorer men could buy bread with the money a single rich man might spend on caviar. It's logic. It's simple math. But money, bread, caviar, even men, do not really work this way. A price is nothing more than a balancing point between supply and demand. While bread and caviar have their own balancing points, prices, which can be compared to each other, there's no direct translation between bread and caviar themselves. The price of bread is set by how much bread there is. And a poor man goes hungry because there isn't enough bread for everyone to get their fill. The price of caviar is set by how much caviar there is. And most of us might go without because there is only enough for some men to get their fill. The high price of caviar is the mechanism that enforces this reality. Are you following me here? Are you feeling the love? So let me digress just a moment. I just received in the mail, just moments before my show started, only the most powerful computer graphics card available on the market today. It's the AMD Radeon HD 6690. It is the biggest, most fastest, most powerful graphics card available anywhere in the whole world. And I just got mine. I waited 3 months for this card. Finally, it came out. I waited a couple more weeks for the card. Once it came out, the price for this card started out at just under $900. Yes, you heard me right. For some folks, that's the price of a whole computer. Maybe even two. But I waited. And at some point, I had no choice but to wait because they were on back order. They were selling like hotcakes. Imagine, people were paying, in this economy, nearly $900 for a damn graphics card that goes inside the computer. Never mind that it's the most powerful computer in the whole world and would blow your head clean. Oh, no, that's Dirty Harry. It is the finest. But once once the initial brouhaha died down, once the initial euphoria in Geekland dried up, the price started to come down a little bit. Then it came down a little bit more. Then it came down a little bit more. Next thing you know, it was on sale for $6.99. And then it was time to bargain. I headed over to Amazon.com. I noticed that the prices still range somewhere between $800 and $650, the lowest price being the $650 price. However, that price came from a seller who hadn't really established a reputation. So they were almost like an untrusted seller. You didn't know what you were going to get. You could go ahead and buy and take your chances. Or you could go with a seller that was selling it for $800 who had been in business with Amazon for a number of years. You knew you could trust them. They had a good reputation. Well, what do you think I did? That's right. I chose the seller who was new to the market because I wanted to save at least $100. And so I ordered the card and I held my breath. Finally, the card came. I inspected the box to make sure the box hadn't been opened, make sure my product wasn't some used piece of crap, a knockoff. I'm satisfied. That's what the market is all about. That's what it's all about. It's not about me telling the story of me owning the finest graphics card known to man so I can go on a computer gaming with GDT of the GDT show later on and stomp him down in any game we choose to play. No, it's not about that. No, maybe it is a little about that. But it's about the free market system. Supply and demand. The demand for the graphics card was high at the beginning, so the price was high. Once the demand was satisfied and most of us geeks had our graphics card, then the price came down. All that was needed to do was wait. I hope that story makes some sense to somebody other than the fact of me promoting this fine graphics card graphics card that I have sitting here on the floor that I cannot wait to put into my machine and load up. So, now that I've digressed into some personal crap, let's get back to the story. Like I said, we were talking about the price of bread versus caviar and the question that was posed to Ayn Rand. The price of bread is set by how much bread there is. The price of caviar is set by how much caviar there is. It's a free market system. Consider, if you will, a middle-class family, an air-conditioned house, two cars, a refrigerator, a couple of TVs, some cell phones, cable or maybe satellite service, ample clothing and food, even special food for their dogs. Who is a poor person? Real class warfare is not bread and caviar. And when we look more closely at it, we see something startling about who's at war with whom. Who is the poor person? Well, a poor person is not somebody who doesn't have caviar. He's someone who doesn't have bread. A poor person is not somebody who isn't rich. He's somebody who isn't even middle class. A poor person is someone who wants for the things the middle class has. You're not poor if you don't have a Cadillac. You're poor if you don't have a car. Prices are a balancing point between supply and demand. Necessary because demand is always greater than supply, as is indicated in the story I just told about the graphics card. And I do apologize for that ringing sound. Apparently I have a call coming in. We'll get rid of that in just a minute. All right. Bam. Done. All right, so back to the story. I do apologize for that interruption. As I said, prices are a balancing point between supply and demand. Necessary, like I said, because demand is always greater than supply. A price is set at a level where products are being consumed at the same rate at which they're being produced. Now, set prices too high and goods accumulate on the shelves. Set them too low and the shelves go bare until the next shipment arrives, as is the indication with the graphics card I just talked about. This is basic economics, folks. Consumers are in competition for goods, and a price is something that it discourages consumers until there are just as many people consuming as there are goods being produced, i.e. the graphics card story. The poor, then, are people who are lost or who are losing the competition with the middle class, not the rich. Think about it. Society never says, this poor man needs a Learjet. You wouldn't raise money to help the family down the street because it can't afford caviar. The poor aren't in trouble because they don't have money. But they are in trouble if they can't get bread. And you don't have to look in the rich man's pantry to see where the bread is actually going. Poor people don't go without because rich people have a lot of money. They go without because the middle class buys up all the goods. So while we think of a class warfare, as a struggle between rich and poor, it's really a struggle between the poor and the middle class. The rich are just scapegoats, convenient scapegoats nonetheless, since they do happen to have wealth. Class warfare is based on the notion that we can settle the dispute over goods between the poor and the middle class by simply taking wealth from the rich. The same wealth, which is often the basis of middle class jobs. But what's surprising is that this is simply not that complicated. It's easy to get hung up on money and to see poverty as a shortage of money. But it's not particularly difficult to see the real issue. The problem is that there's an entire movement of politically motivated people who need you thinking about it in a certain way in order to advance their own agenda. And I'm talking about the Occupy Wall Street folks and President Obama and all of those Democrats who are pushing class warfare right now. And while it may be beneficial for them, if they can convince you to see things their way, it won't necessarily help you, or the poor for that matter. Truly, solving problems starts with truly understanding them. And the people who promise to solve the most problems never seem to explain them truthfully. There are cheats and there are fools. I can't do anything about the cheats. They're going to lie to you forever. But maybe together we can do something about the foolishness. This is the John Galt line. Who is John Galt? We are all John Galt, those of us who produce. Now, I spoke earlier about the graphics card. Some would consider the story to be somewhat self-serving and grandiose, and me bragging about being able to afford a graphics card while there are those who can't afford to have a computer, let alone a $600 graphics card. That's not the point of the story, because by me shelling out the money that I put out for that graphics card, I bought that graphics card from an up-and-coming company, which happens to promote their wares on Amazon.com. I took a risk by buying a product for nearly $700 from a seller who has not yet developed a reputation on Amazon.com, a small business. I don't know how many people this business employs. I don't know if it's just a person selling stuff out of their garage. I don't care. I participated in the free market system. I bought a product that is the very best product available of its kind. And I bought it for less than the retail price. That's what it's all about, folks. That's what we're talking about here. Free market. The market dictates the price. Now, when the product first came out, it was all about how it was the most powerful and how everybody wanted it, and it was flying off the shelves, and there was a 3 to 4 week wait. It was always out of stock. But once the price died down, once it all, the dust settled, and pretty much everybody who wanted one had one, that price dropped. And that's when I made my move. You're listening to the C. Robert Jones Situation Report. We'll be right back.
I remember America. Sure, you can still find it on a map, but nobody older than 20 thinks this is America. Even if coordinates are the same, we've lost our compass. You don't have a direction without reference, the true north. For America, it was liberty. When we lost the love of liberty, our understanding of liberty, it was just a matter of time before the rest of it was lost. Some think it started when the auto companies were nationalized, or the police state to control the internet, or when certain companies couldn't fail because their relationship with politicians made them too big to fail, and the rest of us, without political influence, were too small to succeed. Sure, that all happened pretty quickly, over just a couple of years, but liberty had been gradually devolving for decades. Some of the more astute, like Ayn Rand, saw it about 50 years before others. She warned us, but people didn't believe it could happen here until it did. Laws had been used to loot productive individuals and businesses, but in the new millennium, under Bush and Obama, graft, corruption, and crony capitalism were no longer hidden behind closed doors. The looters and their laws came out of hiding like rabid animals that were no longer afraid of humans. It was brought into the spotlight, and it was celebrated as enlightened economic policy. Ayn Rand asked the question Atlas Shrugged that the rest of us were asking 60 years later. Which failing financial institution will the administration pluck from the flames of crisis? And which will it let roast? Which market or investment technique will the regulators bless? And which, in a capricious change of rules, will it condemn or outlaw? As John Galt said in his radio address,
you decided you had a right to your wages, but we had no right to our profits. You called it selfish and cruel that men should trade value for value. But you've now established an unselfish society where they trade extortion for extortion.
People who had never produced or managed anything tried to manage every aspect of our lives, and they brought production to a standstill. And eventually, they decided to micromanage the food supply in the name of fairness and safety. And we all know what happened then. Fiction can be a powerful influence, for good or bad. It's too bad more people didn't read Atlas Shrugged. They might have realized where this was heading.
Welcome to the Wahoo Media Network. You can listen and participate with Insane Government, hosted by Victor Michalowski, a 16-year-old who has learned more about politics than most adults do in their whole life. The Conservative Report with Dr. C. Robert Jones is an unapologetic conservative view of the insane world of American politics. You get pure, unadulterated, hardcore conservative, historical, and opinion-based news. Stay Mad Radio is hosted by David Graham, author of the popular book, Stay Mad, Observations of a Proletarian. No violence or revolution. This is a call for Tea Partiers to take their anger with them to the ballot box in 2012. Leave political correctness at the door and cast informed votes. We Are America, hosted by Craig Shaw, architect of the Wahoo Media Network, is a weekly roundtable discussion on the current issues facing America. Each week you will find different panelists. And you can learn more by visiting radio.waaumedia.com.
All All right, we're back with the C. Robert Jones Situation Report. You know, one of many things that struck me in learning the story of Ayn Rand, the author of The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged, was that she believed in the capitalist system. She believed in worth for worth, value for value, and that a person should live their lives for themselves, not for the sake of someone else. A person should not spend their lives living for another person, producing for another person, but for themselves. Interesting? In that Miss Rand, comes from the Soviet Union. She grew up in the Soviet Union, where it was about collectivism. It was not about living your life for yourself. It was not about living your life producing for yourself. It was not about value for value. It was about working for the state in a collective. She understood the perils of that sort of system of servitude, unwanted servitude, forced servitude. But we have Americans here who are socialist, who are Marxist, who are communist, who have never lived in a communist system, socialist system, Marxist system. But somehow they believe it's the right thing to do. It's good for the country. Folks who have never, ever lived in a system like that believe that that system is just and it will work. Never mind history. Never mind that it's all around us, that it simply does not work. These people have never lived, for the most part, in systems like this. Now, a former Soviet citizen confronts a socialist at Occupy Wall Street and pretty much tells the story. Check it out.
What are you going to replace it with, I wonder?
Socialism.
Really?
Yeah.
And what do you think is going to happen under socialism?
Well, we wouldn't have people unemployed.
Really?
We wouldn't have people
hungry. No kidding.
We wouldn't have 5% of the world's population.
Really?
25% of
What's the difference between North Korea and South Korea, I wonder? What is the difference between North Korea and South Korea?
The workers in North Korea get paid.
Really?
Yeah.
Really? And nobody imprisons them, nobody kills them, they're not dying from hunger,
no.
They do not resort to cannibalism, and people in South of Korea... Never heard of it.
Really? The Koreans are eating each other?
Really? Never heard of it. That's how bad it is in North Korea.
Well, you have to remember that North Korea is that only a small percentage of the land is
fossil. Well,
they're being choked by imperialism.
Here's the difference between socialism and capitalism.
What?
Capitalism, people prosper. Socialism, people die. Millions.
No.
You know, lady, I was born in USSR. I lived there for 29 years.
Really?
I know the heck what I'm talking about. You have no freaking clue what socialism is all about.
Yeah,
all right? And so I'm speaking from first-hand experience. Millions of people dead. And this is one of the mass murderers. Che Guevara, he's a mass murderer. No, you don't think so.
You're in exile.
Really?
Okay, you're one of the rich people they threw out of the country because you were robbing the people.
Yeah, good luck with that. Good luck with socialism.
So what are you doing here?
Well, just watching at the stupid people like you. Occupying my square, occupying my town. I live over here. What the hell are you doing over here? What are you doing over here?
I'm occupying Wall Street.
Well, you're not allowed to occupy the Wall Street. This is my town. Well,
no.
Because this is my town. You're doing it illegally.
No, the people of New York should be bailed out, not all these damn banks.
They're really
the people. Who are you for, by the way?
The rich?
I am for capitalism. Yes, I am for rich. What kind of capitalism?
Wait a second. Give me your definition. What is capitalism, by the way?
Well, what's your definition of capitalism?
The definition of capitalism is the one where private property is sacred. Mr.
Private property? No, this is capitalism. People with a lot of capital want to make profit on people like this, me and you.
You're very much
working people.
Look it up.
You understand?
Look
in the dictionary. I have the American Standard Dictionary. That's where I got the thing. I don't have to look it up. I know it.
So what's socialism?
You don't know shit about it.
Well, if that's your argument, then there is no point of arguing any further.
No, not here.
All right. Yeah. Whatever.
That's the story. What I found, now, what did you take from that? That the people who are out protesting on Wall Street and other places across the country believe that socialism is the way to go. Marxism is the way to go. And in some cases, communism is the way to go. Now, I laid out the differences between South Korea and North Korea on a show earlier last week. This gentleman who grew up in the Soviet Union believes in capitalism. Why? Primarily because it's good, but why else? Because he lived in a system where capitalism did not exist. He lived in a system where personal servitude to the state was the order of the day, where it was not possible to get rich thinking up, build a Cabbage Patch doll or a Beanie Baby or painting a face, a happy face on a rock and calling it the Pet Rock. Or what was that thing I bought from a back of a cartoon, a comic book years ago when I was just a kid? They were called Sea Monkeys. Does anybody remember the Sea Monkeys? They were just little, dried shrimp. You put them in the water and they swim around for a little bit. But in the back of the comic, they were like little people. And they had their little houses under the sea. It was really cool. So I sent away, collected my little pennies, saved up, dollar and some change, and sent the money in for those damn sea monkeys. I don't fault the person who sold them to me. For making it seem like they were like a bunch of little people. No. He's probably still filthy rich off of that crap. But that's what America's all about. Free enterprise. There's a sucker born every minute. And I love it. But here's the thing. The man made a point. The man who spoke to the so-called socialist out on Occupy Wall Street. And his point was this. You believe in socialism right up until the time you have to live in it. Now, I was stationed near the DMZ in South Korea as part of an attachment with the ROC Marines, the Republic of Korea Marines. We have a very distinct relationship, the United States Marines and the ROC Marines. We work together. There are over 30,000 U.S. soldiers stationed in South Korea, mostly to protect South Korea from North Korea. But I have seen, I'm going to tell you right now, I've seen firsthand North Koreans risking their lives every single day I was there to make their way over to South Korea. I mean, seriously, it was like the Berlin Wall, but only in Korea. The folks in South Korea live in a capitalist system. The folks in North Korea live in a Marxist, communist system. They are starving there. The only people who can afford anything at all are the Kim Jong-ils and people who associate with those folks. Very few people. The rest of the people are literally starving to death. The last word I got from one of my Marines is that the North Koreans were eating, boiling tree bark, folks, as sustenance because they didn't have enough food. They didn't have clean water. This is a communist system. not the free market system. Now, the folks across the way, the 38th parallel, over just across from the DMZ, called South Koreans, they're living large over there, and they're happy for the most part. Why? Because it's a capitalist system. But we have here in America people who are misguided. They have never lived in a system that is as repressive as the Soviet Union or Cuba or South Korea, or I mean North Korea or China. But somehow they believe that it's the best way to go. Why don't they just relocate there to one of those countries? I'm sure they'd be glad to take them. I don't know. But I can tell you this. Every famous person or so-called famous person, from Lee Harvey Oswald all to some famous actors whose names escape me right now, from way back, who have moved up to the Soviet Union, left anywhere from 18 months to 2 years later. Lee Harvey Oswald, former Marine and sniper, killer of JFK, thought he was moving to a utopia, a socialist utopia, until he was laid up, cramped in a one-room apartment, working 14 hours a day, taking home just a few rubles, and had his place bugged, folks listening in 24 hours a day. Then that idiot decided it was a good idea to come back home. Yeah. Here's the thing. America is a great country. We're the best. We're the best at almost everything. But folks aren't satisfied. Because the fact that we have a president who is agitating, playing up this class warfare. Wait. Is anybody surprised at all? When the president of the United States started just over two and a half years ago calling bankers fat cats, and then started with this rhetoric about corporate jets and millionaires and billionaires. Does anyone not believe that he set this whole thing in motion? The president of the United States. Did anybody think four years ago, at the latter part of the Bush presidency, that we would have a president of the United States openly pit one group of Americans against another? Us versus them, the rich versus the poor. The politics of envy. Bernie Goldberg wrote in a column just yesterday, he wrote, "It's in difficult times, a wise man once said, it's important to state the obvious." So here goes. Barack Obama cannot run for re-election touting his successes in economic matters. That's mainly because he has no success in economic matters. Now, this is Bernie Goldberg writing. He can't brag about a low unemployment rate because it's over 9%. He can't boast about the growing economy, which is barely growing and may even slide back into a recession. He can't tell the voters about all the new, clean, green jobs he's creating because he isn't. Can you say Solyndra? And perhaps you've noticed that he's already stopped talking about how many millions of any kind of jobs his administration has created or saved, and is now talking about all the jobs his policies have supported, whatever that means. So what can he do, folks? Only one thing: wage class warfare. Turn Americans against each other based on envy. Divide Americans into two camps, the greedy rich who don't contribute their fair share on one side, and all the downtrodden, decent people struggling for a better life or another. Who have we heard of in human history who has been noted to do such things? Yeah, his name is Lucifer. Now, I'm not equating the President of the United States with the devil incarnate. No, I wouldn't do that. That wouldn't be fair to the devil. But pitting Americans against each other simply for personal political gain, well, that would be bad enough. But for a president who rode into office on a major carpet, a magic carpet of lofty promises about hopes and dreams to make America better, a better post-partisan place, it's truly despicable. It is. And Bernie Goldberg had it right. Because to me, Bernie Goldberg is stating the obvious. Nothing, absolutely nothing, is the same as race in America. But something like this, politics of division, have been tried before. Racist politicians in the Old South divided Americans based on the color of their skin. And they did it for just one reason, to win elections. They didn't care about the harm they were doing. They cared only about themselves, turning Americans against each other by over and over and over again telling the middle class, where the majority of the votes just happen to reside, that Republicans are the Maria Antoinette party, that care only about the millionaires and billionaires and don't give a damn about anybody else. Well, it isn't as bad as promising to keep those ends in their place, but it's pretty bad. It's pretty bad. And here we have a black president doing this very same thing. And what do black folks say about this? Well, forget about the record. Tom Joyner famously said, or infamously said just a couple of weeks ago, never mind the record. Forget about the truth. Forget about the facts. We need to re-elect Barack Hussein Obama just because he's black. Those were quite nearly his exact words. Turning Americans against each other. The President of the United States. How many of you who are as old as I am? I'm 49. Some of you are a lot younger. Some of you are older. How many of you ever thought that we'd live in a country where the President of the United States would literally turn Americans against each other? Not say that, well, hey, you know, my policies are better, and here's the reason why. No. He's pitting Americans against Americans like we're in Civil War mode. And just as this sort of vilification, vitriolic, us versus them rhetoric worked back in the Old South, the politics of envy may work again. According to a Time magazine poll, 79% of Americans familiar with the Occupy Wall Street protest believe that the gap between the rich and the poor in the U.S. is too large, and 68% believe the rich should pay more in taxes. Never mind that the poor aren't poor because the rich are rich. In fact, if we had fewer rich people, we'd probably have a lot more poor people, since rich people are the ones who invest their money in companies that produce jobs. And even if the rich paid 100% of their income in taxes, it would barely put a dent in the national debt and wouldn't create a single job. Barack Obama, surely he knows this. He has to. I mean, I've called him an idiot. Maybe you have too, but surely he knows basic economics. Surely he is not as dumb as he seems. I hope that he knows this. Americans, the American people are envious enough and dumb enough. There are some envy enough and dumb enough to buy into his class warfare strategy. A lot of those folks are African Americans who just so happen to be for Obama for no other reason than the fact that he's black. President Obama is smooth and can be convincing. He was once, and he may be again. After all, there are a lot of envious, dumb Americans out there who don't have a clue as to how the economy works. But they're sure of one thing, that they hate rich people. And not all of them are occupying Wall Street at this time. Not all of them. But we're going to just let this guy convince us that the rich are the evil ones here. Now, we'll be right back. I'd like for you to take a listen to my main man, Andrew Klavan. And we'll be right back after that, and we'll close out the show. You're listening to the C. Robert Jones Situation Report. And, oh yeah, we've got my main man, Andrew Klavan, coming up. And he also has a commentary on the Glenn Beck program. And he is quite funny, but also extremely accurate.
Andrew Klavan, and this is my very serious commentary. Today, a shocking expose. Left-wing commentators and reporters have uncovered deeply hidden racism within the conservative movement. After African-American presidential candidate Herman Cain surged in recent conservative polls, you might have been tricked into thinking conservatives couldn't give a rat's kebab about the color of a person's skin. But no. Former unemployed actress Janine Garofalo revealed the startling truth that, quote, Herman Cain is probably well-liked by some of the Republicans because it hides the racist elements of the Republican Party. A clever ruse indeed. Conservatives might even have gotten away with the deception were it not for Democratic strategist Cornell Belcher, who further explained to the media that Cain himself is a racist. Our own investigations have confirmed that Cain, in an ugly move reminiscent of segregation days, has been forcing himself to sit in the back of the limousine he earned as a successful businessman. But Cain's popularity on the right is only a small part of a despicable conspiracy by conservatives to disguise their racism by not doing anything racist. For example, as far back as 2010, videos taken at a Tea Party rally revealed that ralliers strategically refrained from shouting racial slurs at passing congressmen, despite the obvious fact that the congressmen were black. Luckily, the quick-thinking lawmakers were able to invent the slurs for a credulous media, thus exposing the true motives behind the Tea Partiers' diabolical inaction. More recently, the virulent racism of Texas Governor Rick Perry was brought to light as the Washington Post published a hard-hitting front-page story revealing that Perry hosted gatherings at a hunting camp where there was a rock with a racial slur on it that had been painted over so no one could see. Unfortunately, documents later surfaced proving that the Washington Post was itself located in a city named after a former slaveholder. The Post's editors said they had not been aware of what city they were in, or indeed what profession they were in. In contrast to the insidious disguising of right-wing racism behind non-racist behavior, stands our president, Barack Obama. An official left-wing approved black man, Obama recently addressed the Congressional Black Caucus, a group of long-suffering African Americans who have been elected to Congress through no fault of their own.
Stop complaining. Stop grumbling. Stop crying. We are going to press on.
Notice how our Harvard-educated leader was able to expertly leave the G's off the ends of his words in the knowledge that black people have difficulty understanding words with G's at the end. It's a genetic thing, apparently. Thus, in the stirring cadences of the down-home preacher he never was, Obama inspired his fellow official blacks to press on with the policies that have lifted African-American unemployment by over 25% since the president took office. Compare that to racist conservatives who insensitively continue to use words ending in G and to advocate the sort of policies favored by racist President Ronald Reagan, under whose racist administration the economic status of blacks improved more than that of any other racial group. Another clever conservative ruse. The racists. I'm Andrew Clavin, and this has been my very serious commentary.
GBTB. The truth lives here.
Indeed it does. Glenn Beck TV. Check it out if you have the means. I am a member of Glenn Beck TV. I also work with his team of researchers, and I thoroughly enjoy my relationship with Glenn Beck and his program. Listen, folks. There's an old Chinese proverb that states, "May you live in interesting times." The meaning in Chinese is, may you experience much disorder and trouble in your life. Well, we, you and I, and everyone within the sound of my voice and those who are not, I submit, are living in interesting times. Now, while the saying, the phrase, while the saying may be or reported or purported to be a blessing, it is in fact a curse. The expression is always used ironically, with the clear implication that interesting times of peace and tranquility are more life-enhancing. I'm sorry, while the implication that uninteresting times of peace and tranquility are more life-enhancing than interesting ones. You may live in interesting times is widely reported as being of ancient Chinese origin. The phrase was introduced in the 20th century in the form of interesting age rather than interesting times, and appeared that way in the opening remarks made by Frederick R. Corden at the proceedings of the Academy of Political Science in 1939. We live, unfortunately, folks, in interesting times. And it's not good. Not at all. Think about that. Think about that tonight and tomorrow. May you live in interesting times. May you experience much disorder and trouble in your life. And while you're thinking of that, tune into the news tonight, preferably Fox News, fair and balanced, and watch the interesting times as they play out. You're listening to the C. Robert Jones Situation Report. Thank you all for listening tonight. God bless you, and God bless the United States of America. We'll see you tomorrow. Come on back. We'll talk again. Beach Bum, Alexander Solo, Blog Talk King, Evil Clown, all my guests, Marine Times, you're in the house, Ned King, New, Pendleton Marines, and everybody else. Sarge is in the house. The Binary Prince, Republican Marine. Good night, folks. God bless you. And may you live in uninteresting times. Good night.
but that was when I ruled the world.